Greetings, listeners, if any, and welcome to DM Dad, the podcast about running D&D and other RPGs for kids. A great way to spend time with your family now that your friends are too old and have all moved away. So, greetings, listeners. I've got a few voice messages to take care of this week, but I'm not going to do that today. Although, really quickly, to RFED, aka Darren Green, aka Rocks Fall, Everyone Dies, thank you very much for the birthday wish. Really appreciate it. But I'm doing something special this week. On Wednesday, as I'm recording this, it's Monday, and on Wednesday, I am running a game of Swords and Wizardry White Box for people more or less my own age. There's a forum here in Edinburgh for RPG players. It's called the Open Role Play Community, ORC, ORC. And a long time ago, somebody had been running first edition AD&D and had basically run through all the series of modules from like Against the Giants all the way onward, kind of just doing the whole run of the classic series of modules. And as far as I know, that's finished and it's over, you know. So I noticed there's a lot of people playing 5th edition. There's still people playing Pathfinder. There's people talking about the Pathfinder playtest. There's people running other systems like Cthulhu and stuff like that. And I looked and looked and looked, and nobody was running any old school D&D anymore since that first edition AD&D game finished. And that was like a year or so ago. So I posted in there, you know, looking for a game or looking to run a game post. I posted, want to play OD original Dungeons & Dragons? And I, you know, laid out my proposal that I would run original Dungeons & Dragons via Swords & Wizardry White Box, especially for people who had only ever played 3rd edition or later. That's what I was basically saying, you know. I'm especially, like, I'll open it to anybody, but I'm especially looking for people who have only ever played Wizards of the Coast era or Pathfinder. I've never played any old school D&D, and I will run original D&D. I mentioned a few of the, I don't know, nuances, you know. All weapons do a d6 of damage. All hit dice are d6s for all classes and also for monsters. No spells beyond 6th level or 5th level for clerics. Clerics don't get a spell at 1st level. All the things that would probably shock you if you'd never played an old school edition. I also said, you know, we're going to roll stats hardcore 3d6 in order, and the order I gave was white box order: strength, intelligence, wisdom, con, dex, charisma. I also pointed out that this is not the kind of game where every time you level up, assuming you survive long enough to level up, that you get magical new powers, you know, like, oh, this, I get access to this magical ability. You know, if you're a spellcaster, you get more spells. Everybody gets more hit points. And eventually, if you live long enough, you will get to establish a stronghold and attract followers. And that's basically it, you know. What you get when you progress through the game is the satisfaction of still being alive, and you probably get some magic items as well. Anyways, I posted that like back in May, and hardly anybody responded. In fact, initially nobody responded, and then I got one respondent, and then for a long time he was like, hey, when can we start this game? And I said, well, I'm gonna wait till there's more than one player, mate, so just watch the space. Yeah, and then nothing happened, and I thought, well, you know, I guess nobody wants to play it. The bright side is I don't have to do anything. You know, I don't have to prep a game or select an adventure or write an adventure. And then, like last month, it started to blow up. like one extra person said, hey, you know, I'd be interested if this ever happens. And I was still like, well, two, I could run a game for two people, but it's, you know, I have an excuse to back out of it if there's still only two people. But I guess what happens on this forum is there's a sidebar on the forum that shows you whichever threads have had the most recent post. So they kind of advertise the thread being active keeps pushing it up, and the most recent post is at the top of that sidebar, and the second most recent post, you know, so basically every time somebody responded to this thread, it pushed that thread way up to the top of the pile, and anybody logging onto the forum would glance at the sidebar and say and see this headline, "Wanna play original Dungeons and Dragons?" And so, you know, Within a couple of weeks, I suddenly had seven people who want to play this game. So now it's happening. Now I have to do this. I can't back out now. And it's happening this Wednesday. So less than 2 days. I don't know if they're going to like it. I don't know if they're going to like me. I don't know if I'm going to like them, which is something I hadn't thought about until I was talking with the group that I play with as a player. I was telling them about how I'm running this game, and I'm only running a one shot in case they don't like the game, or they don't like my DMing style, or they don't like me or something. And one of the other players is like, you also need to make sure that you like them. And like, that is definitely the personality conflicts potentially go both ways, you know? So I need to kind of be like, do I want to keep running for this group if this becomes a regular thing? But I'm running a one shot, or I'm going to attempt to run a one shot. I've never run a one shot in my life before. The one shot that I have selected is Tower of Skulls, which is Josh Beckelheimer's first ever one-page adventure, at least the first one that he kind of posted and published. You can hear about it if you go to his podcast. It's actually, he discusses it on the first episode of his podcast. And having listened to that episode, I went and downloaded it right away. Like as soon as the podcast was over, I went and downloaded it. So I have high hopes that I can finish this in 2 hours, because that's how long we have to play. 2.5. The chuck is, I've booked it to start for 7, and we're playing at my friendly local game store, and they will chuck us out of there at 9:30, because they want to go home. You know, it's not an all night place. So fingers crossed, we can complete this dungeon crawl. It's just a little dungeon crawl, a tower in the middle of a river. The tower is sunk, so you start at the top and go down. And hopefully, yeah, we can do that in 2.5 hours tops. But you know, that'll depend on how long they spend on each area, you know. I am going to give them a race against the clock element, which is that it's not actually in a river, it's in an estuary. It is therefore tidal and very wide. It's too wide to swim from the tower to shore if bad things happen. And because it's tidal, I'm going to be basically rolling dice. I'm going to use like the usage dice mechanic that you get in like the Black Hack and some other games. Every turn, I'm going to roll that die, and every time that die downgrades, the tide is creeping in. And whether they leave the trap door and the roof open or not, it will be bad if the tide comes in while they're down there. They're either going to have to wait for 12 hours for the tide to clear, and then the door will be underwater and extremely difficult to push open, and once they do push open, a flood of water will come and possibly knock them down the stairs. Or if they leave the door open, then water will flood down the stairs and cause flooding in the tower, possibly leading to them drowning, or at least being trapped. So that's how I'm going to do a kind of race against the clock element, and hopefully that will G them up and make sure they don't, you know, dick around in some of the puzzle rooms for way longer than they need to. The reason, though, that I'm talking about it now is, what does this have to do with kids? Well, I've been really nervous about whether I can run this adventure effectively, whether I can run it to time, whether it will, I don't know, whether I'll do a good job. I want to do the adventure justice. I want to do the rule set justice. I mean, it's not a big deal if this edition or this version of the game turns out not to be their thing. This is all just kind of an experiment. But OD&D, especially White Box OD&D, is basically my favorite edition of Dungeons and Dragons, and Swords and Wizardry White Box is my favorite version of that rule set. And I want to present it in the best possible light, you know. If they don't like it because they don't like it, that's one thing, but I don't want them to not like it because I did a bad job running it. So I feel a lot of pressure. I would feel that pressure anyway, though, because I feel a lot of anxiety whenever I'm going to interact socially with people I've never met before. Anyways, one of the things I did to try to kind of ease my nerves is I play tested this with my kids, or at least with one of my kids. My son is still finding it a little hard to concentrate for long periods of time after school. You know, just starting school, it's a long day for him. So he wasn't really participating, and my 8-year-old ended up running all four characters. But we basically took the characters that they've been running anyway, and I said, we're just play testing this adventure, so if you die, it doesn't count. We'll just call it a dream sequence or something. But she ran through it. And the good news is that it came out. There's a good chance that I'll be able to keep to time. We'll be able to do the whole thing within 2.5 hours. I mean, one X factor is she didn't need to roll up characters. So we're gonna have to make character creation take as little as possible. And character creation in White Box is easy anyway. To speed it up, I'm gonna have them buy weapons, and then we're gonna do the Untold Adventures style equipment slots. Like, don't buy mundane equipment. I don't want them spending 2 hours thinking about whether they need a box of caltrops and stuff like that. And just like, you all just, after you buy your weapons, take 25 gold off whatever you had, and that will buy you 5 equipment slots. And if you don't have 25 left, then whatever you do, we'll call it 5 gold per slot. And then if while you're doing the actual adventure, you need a certain piece of mundane equipment, presto, you have it. Not cross off one of your slots, and now you have whatever you said you know, whether it's a torch or a 10-foot pole or some rope or a flask of oil or ball bearings or anything you can think of, as long as it's not a weapon or a magic item or something that it hasn't been amended yet. For instance, I hate these systems that basically use matches and they call them tinder twigs. It's like, look, there's no reason for that. All right. It's not like you need an ability check to use a tinderbox. So why do you need a fantasy rewrite of matches? You know, I guess technically it takes a minute to like a full minute of game time, but if you're not in combat and you need to light a torch, I'm not going to roll a wandering monster check on you for 1 minute of game time to light your tinder, to start a fire with your tinder box and light a torch. That's just not worth anybody's time. I also don't like the solar. I think they're basically like flare. They're called sun rods or something. They're basically like flares. I feel like, you know, I hate that crap. You might as well have like a calculator, you know. Like, I have a fantasy reskin of a calculator. It's called the Number Box, you know. Anyways. So, yeah, unless it's magical, a weapon, or hasn't been invented yet, you can have it. And that should hopefully be, you know, roll your 3d6 7 times for your stats and your gold, buy your weapons and your armor, take another 25 off, and then let's go. So, anyways, yeah, one thing I noticed about this adventure, it really freaked my daughter out in a way I didn't expect. So, She once again, she showed really great gamer skills. So I set her up. I said, "Okay, you're in this town." I told her the name of the town, and I said, "Headless bodies are washing up on the shore." And she said, "That's weird." And she said she wanted to go do some research about, as she asked questions, we eventually got to the fact that you can see the top of a tower in the middle of the estuary. You can see it from the shore. It's about halfway between the shore that the town is on and the other side of it. And she asked about the tower, and she said she wanted to do some research, and there's no library in town, but she went to the tavern where all the fishermen go and talked to a lot of fishermen and got various stories about the tower and stuff like that. But that was her first port of call. She's like, "I want to do some research here. I want to like find out more." And once again, 8 years old, excellent gamer skill. She could do like the, I don't think they do this anymore, but they used to do like the competitions at cons where, you would get points and stuff for running through a module. In fact, I think Tomb of Horrors used to be done as a competition. She would be really good at that. So she got as much information as it was possible to get. And then she paid one of the fishermen, or actually two, because they wouldn't all fit in the same boat. So they split the party into two boats. She had to pay two fishermen that were brave enough to row out to the top of the tower. And then there were crenellations, and there were also these things jutting out kind of perpendicular. Maybe they used to hold banners or flags, or maybe they used to be pedestals for gargoyles, or right now they're just basically little spears of stone, but they're things that they could tie the boat up to and then climb up. Now, the eyes of frogs were kind of peeping up in the water as they neared the tower. And she's like, "How big are they?" And it's like, "Well, I guess from what you can see, like the tops of their heads and their eyes, proportionally, you would guess they were maybe about the size of a dog." And she's like, "So they couldn't swallow us whole." It's like, no, they're not. They don't appear to be that big." She's like, "Okay, that's good." So she gets onto the roof of the tower. Now, because it's tidal, at high tide, water laps over the battlements. So there's some ankle deep standing water there. And there is a trap door. It's clearly visible, but of course it's underwater, so it's going to be hard to lift that up. So she does the thing where three people can, grasp. There's an iron ring that that three PCs can grasp and like heave ho, kind of try to hoist it up. So she rolls 3d6, one open doors check for each PC. All fail, and at that point, four giant frogs leap onto the battlements and kind of do this little screechy croak and prepare to attack. So that was the first combat. What actually happened was, well, the party won the initiative. So since they were by the trapdoor, which is more like in the middle of the tower, they weren't within melee distance. But this party is pretty good on ranged weapons. So in place of movement, she, got her bow and knocked an arrow. And swords and wizardry bows have a firing rate of two per combat encounter. So she got to shoot two frogs right off the bat. She didn't. She only killed one. But that was pretty good. And then it got to the spells when we were resolving the spells, and this was basically my son's one contribution as we managed to get him over here and choose which spell he had prepared. And he prepared sleep, so he cast sleep. And of course, there's no save for sleep, so he rolled 2d6, and that put all the frogs to sleep. Now, I mean, that's a bad move, burning your one spell per day in the first encounter. But it did mean that they got there without taking any losses. It just also means that they have no spells to work with for the rest of the encounter. So then they manage to pull, after the frogs are asleep, they do manage to pull the trap door open. Water rushes down, so that drains all the water from the roof. And that water flows down the stairs. Now we go to a lot of we have a lot of ruined castles here in Scotland, as you can probably imagine. And a lot of them are free or very cheap to go to, especially if they're proper ruins. So we've taken the kids to many, many castles. They've been up and down the old staircases. They've seen how these stone staircases, including the spiral ones, they're very worn in the middle. Hundreds of years of feet going up and down them. They're worn smooth and there's these dips in them. And, here in the 21st century, looking up them, you think, especially as an adult, you're like, that is not safe. So I described like that using the, real world castles as a benchmark, and said, they already would have been slippery and smooth, but now they're wet. So she decided to move cautiously down, like at a half speed. There's no railing or any safety features like that. But what really creeped her out was she realized that they were going under the level of the water. And she was worried about flooding. I said, well, yeah, if there are any windows, then wherever the windows reach into, yeah, that will be flooded. And she's like, well, we don't have a potion of water breathing. It's like, well, you'll know before you go in. You're not going to just accidentally stroll into a water, like a flooded thing, and not realize it until it's too late. That's not how this works. You'll know if it's too wet for you to go into. But she was very, very careful about all the doors, including kind of like she was really asking about wetness. She didn't want to open a door and unleash a torrent of water. And it's good that she did that, because there are actually several areas where if you open the door, a torrent of water will come and knock you down or possibly drown you. In fact, there's one thing that if a cult member, there's a cult in this tower worshipping some evil river monster. There's one door that a cult member, if they're losing the battle, will actually open on purpose in order to kill everybody in the room. But she was able to neutralize that. She was able to kill the cult member before he reached the door. But what really got her was the adventure specifically says that you're going to hear chanting, so I did the chanting, and she found that very creepy. And I think the tension of being underwater, of not feeling like she can just open any door because water might rush out and drown her. And, I described there's a statue of the monster in one room well before you meet it, so at least you can see what it looks like. And I described that, and it's a bespoke monster. It's something that Josh Bechelheimer just kind of came up with. It's kind of like, he calls it like a squid serpent. So I described it as it's like a squid, or like a serpent, but instead of the head of a snake, it basically turns into a squid, and it has six tentacles and a squid beak. So the statue was coiled up like a serpent, and the head was ready to strike, but the head wasn't a snake's head. It was a squid's tentacles and little beak in the middle. And of course, because it was a statue, she could see in detail that the tentacles were actually made of skulls. So that was a pretty creepy image. But yeah, I didn't expect her to be this. She's not normally this squeamish about adventure details. But she said later, she said that the chanting especially really creeped her out. By the time she got to the final encounter, it basically ended in a TBK, which of course it doesn't matter for this case because it was just a play test. So I said, remember, we're just running this as like a dream sequence or something. It doesn't mean your characters have actually died. But yeah, they, four level one characters were just no match for the final encounter. Although I should have six or seven, so that might even the odds. And also, the door that they came in when they discover the final room, they can run out of it if they need to just run away. But it was good to see that I can definitely run this conceivably within the time. And I thought, if I need to if one bit takes place too like takes longer than I anticipated, I might need to cut an encounter. So I asked her, I'm like, of all the encounters I ran, if I had to cut one for time, which would you cut? And I was actually thinking of the frogs, and she said, no, don't cut the frogs, because that's a really unique encounter. I was like, you're right, that's the only time you fight giant frogs. Also, that functions as the guardian of the dungeon. That's kind of why they're there. If you manage to get the door, if you manage to get the trap door open on your first try, the frogs don't attack. They attack if you fail. And then you can fight them or you can keep trying to open the door. They will not pursue you into the dungeon. They're just there to make a bit more tension of you trying to get that door open. Although on round two, a larger frog will join the fight. He has more hit points and he's capable of swallowing a halfling whole. Not anything bigger than a halfling, no. But he will probably try to swallow the halfling and swim away with them. So that could end, that could spice that encounter up. But she said, don't cut the frogs, because that's kind of a unique encounter. So I'll probably keep the frogs. But there was also an encounter. The adventure says that in one room, they should find a headless corpse. And because where I put the headless corpse, they had quite a lot of rooms that didn't have any particular danger. It had been a long time since they had been through the trap, and they'd had more like puzzles and things. And I thought this felt like a place where there should be some more danger. So I go ahead and I have that headless corpse animate an attack. Because it's headless, it's blind, therefore it fights it at a -4 penalty as per Swords and Wizardry white box rules. However, it's a one-hit die monster, so it would add +1 to its attack roll, so that would make it -3, and it's a berserker, so it gets a +2. Basically fights as a berserker. So it's really only fighting at -1, even though it can't see. So that'll, you know, it's just one, so it shouldn't be hard to beat. The point is more that it's creepy, because ideally they'll investigate it first and then it will attack. The way I ran this for my daughter is the noise from that encounter, caused another group of cultists to come in. Basically one ordinary cult member and four kind of minions who I ran as bandits. So they fought them. And then in the floor, the bottom floor of the dungeon, where they find the actual well that leads to where they summon the river monster Rultzak, that's where they find a cult mystic who's actually capable of casting a couple of cleric spells and has quite a lot of hit points, and a number of the other cult members, not the bandits, but the ordinary cult members. So there's four of them and a cult mystic. And the thing is that apart from just being up one level, you know, in terms of difficulty, it's a very similar encounter. It's one leader and four mooks, basically. So we talked about it, and I think I'll probably cut that encounter. I may even cut it even if we're not running close to the time limit, just because it's too similar. It's like, yeah, you fight one leader and four minions, and then you fight one more powerful leader and four more powerful minions. You might as well fight the headless corpse and then get to the main event. And I guess depending on how that encounter goes, they may or may not successfully summon Rultzak. If they do, Rultzak is like, I think, 12 hit die equivalent. Actually, I have it written down right here. So he's very powerful. It's very unlikely that they would survive an encounter. 10 hit dying. So he's got eight actual hit dice, but his hit die equivalent is 10, because if he hits, he gets two tentacle attacks, and if he hits with both of them, then he grapples you and bites your head off. And he heals when he bites your head off. Because the skulls that make up his tentacles are actually human skulls. And every time he eats a skull, one of his tentacles gets longer. And so he'll actually heal. So you don't want to fight Rultzak. You want to dispatch them before they are capable of summoning him. And there's a specific process that I've written that they have to, because it doesn't say in the style of the One Page Adventures is it doesn't specify a lot of detail. It gives you these concepts, these kind of broad strokes in this framework, and then you fill in all the blanks and all the details yourself. So I, based on the map that I selected, which is basically, it's one of the Dyson Logos maps. As I was looking for maps for this, I had this idea of how I wanted the tower to look, and I basically wanted it to look a lot like the tower in the Wizard's Tower, the James Bond Swords and Wizardry white box. And eventually I'm like, why don't I just use that map? Because it's a Dyson Logos map. You can, I mean, well, I think you can use it for free if you want to publish it, but I'm not even publishing it. I'm just using it at the table. So, I mean, you can rip off any map you want and just repurpose it at the table. But I'm like, if this is how I want the tower to look, I'm just going to use this map. So that's what I'm using. And based on the shape of the room and what I want each thing to kind of represent, I came up with a process that the cult will use to summon Rultzak. So it's possible for the party to interrupt that and not have to fight Rultzak. If they do, they better, if Rultzak is summoned, they better get the hell out of there. So it was a pretty successful playtest. And it once again showed that my daughter has some pretty good skills and pretty good instincts as a gamer. Since then I've been kind of fleshing out some of the room descriptions because I felt it got a little bit samey. So I've been rolling up some random dungeon dressing and things like that from using primarily Matt Finch's Tome of Adventure Design. And hopefully I haven't overloaded everything with information that I won't remember now in the day. Another thing that I learned from the playtest is to ease off on the stuck doors check, because that works really well in a dungeon where there's lots of possible doors to check. So if one or two of them you can't get through on this trip, that's fine. But with this tower structure, there's basically one path, And if you can't get through that door, then I guess, all right, let's go back to town. So I'm gonna have to either not do it at all or kind of do it where there's other options in case they fail, And that's just good advice generally. Never roll dice unless you're willing to accept the consequence of failure. So, anyways, the other thing I'm doing in prep for this game on Wednesday is I am rolling up backup or spare characters in case of death. I posted that I was going to run this game on only one of the several Facebook groups I could have posted on, which was the original edition Dungeons and Dragons Facebook group. I could have posted on the Swords and Wizardry ones as well, but I guess I'm so squeamish about this game that I just kind of I wanted to keep it on the low key. But when I mentioned I was running Swords and Wizardry White Box, the first comment I got was that somebody else who had run it said, "Yeah, make sure they bring hirelings or spare characters and stuff like that. It's pretty lethal." And yeah, this adventure is clearly pretty lethal as well. Which is not to say it's unsurvivable. It's just, survival is not a given. So, anyways, I've got so far six spare characters. I've just basically been rolling 3d6 over and over again in my spare time and then saying, that looks like a cleric. And then I buy them weapons and armor, and then I don't buy them any gear. Since we're going to be using the gear slots thing, that won't matter anyway, but my original intention was that, you would meet these people, like they would be trapped in a certain room or something like that. They've lost all their normal gear. All they have left is their weapons. They'll buy more gear. If they become your new character, you can buy them more gear when they get back to town. So I've got a cleric, well, obviously a human cleric because all clerics are human. I'm going ahead. I'm allowing them to have max hit points. I didn't always do that. For instance, the first time I ever ran White Box for my daughter, we rolled hit points, and you got the usual numbers you'd expect, very low numbers. But for the basically precursor to Arapanathuk that I'm running for both my kids, their hit point scores were so low that they talked me into just, allowing them to start with max. And to be honest, starting your first level character with 6 hit points isn't a big deal. It's not like breaking the game or anything. So they're all starting. We're all going to start with max hit points. Give you a chance to take at least a couple of hits before you realize that you should run away. So, cleric, wisdom 14, so it doesn't get that bonus, and it will not have a spell. An elf, so the elf is obviously can choose between fighter and magic user, and I guess I will if somebody chooses this character, I will let them decide whether they're playing the elf as a fighter or a magic user. Strength 12, so not a particularly gifted fighter, but competent nonetheless. But 16 intelligence, so they got a plus one. So I mean, I would suggest magic user. And to that extent, I only gave them leather armor and a sword for their equipment. Human fighter with a 17 strength, so that's pretty good. 13 intelligence, wisdom of 16. So this is the only pre-rolled character I've got that gets the full 10% experience point bonus, the 5% for the high strength and 5% for the high wisdom. And because of their strength, I'm running the optional rule where they get a plus one to attack and damage because they're a fighter. So this is a pretty good fighter. AC 17, plate and shield, and they are just encumbered. So their movement is only 9. Halfling thief, but well, so 16 dex, which is why I decided to do this as a thief. I was only going to roll up the 3 original classes, but I got an 8 strength, a 6 intelligence, and an 8 wisdom. So it wasn't looking very good. A 4 con, so -1 to their hit points. But then the dex came up 16, and I was like, okay, well, it looks like we got a thief here. So because they're a halfling, I guess they would do better against large creatures, So that, I don't know. I have a feeling nobody will choose this one, but it's apart from the hit points, it's not a bad character. And then I was rolling up what looked like a mediocre fighter. So strength 12, intelligence 10, wisdom 7, con 3. So again, -1 to their hit points. Dex 10. I was just like, man, I might have to throw this character out. And then charisma 17. So I'm like, charisma 17, eh? So I decided that I would go ahead and make this as the kind of the James Spawn white box version of the paladin. So it's a human paladin. Apart from that, not a very, I mean, because of that 3 con, you're always going to take a penalty to your hit points. So not a particularly great character. They've got plate, but not a shield. So their AC is only 16. I can't remember now why I didn't buy him a shield as well. He's got the money. Maybe it's a two-handed sword. That would make sense. In fact, I think I'm going to go ahead and do that. It's going to be a two-handed sword. So that's 1d6 plus 1. That would make sense. Like, why else would I not buy him a shield? Two-handed. So, and of course, at level 1, he'll be able to restore a measly 1 hit point by laying on hands, I guess once per day. Then I rolled up another fighter. Only a 15 strength, but still enough to get that bonus. In fact, he started off as a 14. And he had an 11 wisdom. And I nerfed the wisdom to 9 to give him an extra strength point to get him that that bonus. So in a lot of ways, not as good a fighter as the other fighter I rolled. But, you know, still not bad either. In fact, to be honest, there's very little difference between a 17 and a 15 strength in this game. So in a lot of ways, I think he's not as smart. He's only an 8 intelligence, so he won't have extra languages and things. But has the same bonus to attack rolls and damage and the same AC and the same amount of hit points. I bought this guy a short bow and some arrows just so that he would have a ranged attack option as well. Because of that, he's encumbered enough to only have a movement of 6. So it might be the kind of thing of ditching the bow and arrows, which will bring his encumbrance down to allow him to move at 9. So that's 6. And there's 7 total respondents through the forum, and then I've invited one extra person who's a more experienced player to come along. He might come along, he might not. But I was hoping he would be kind of like the anchor player, especially because he's played old school D&D back in the day. So he should have some good skills about how to approach challenges and obstacles in an old school way and maybe be able to steer them. So that could be as many as 8. So I would like to have at least one backup character per death, because I doubt they'll lose 2 characters unless they're particularly reckless. So I'm going to roll up these last 2 right now. And that is a 6 for strength. So, that's -1. That's bad. I am using these 3 wooden dice that I got out of a Christmas cracker. They roll terribly. Although, just as I say that, there's a 16. So it looks like we have another wizard. And that's 7, 8, 9 wisdom. So yeah, definitely a wizard. Here comes the con for the. I'm doing this on index cards where I've filled them out myself, like just written my own little index cards, and I'm doing them in white box order. So strength, intelligence, wisdom, con, dex, charisma. I'm also bringing some character sheets, like blank character sheets, to the game. I'm bringing 8 sheets of Bloat Games OSR Deluxe character sheet, which you can download for free from DriveThruRPG or any of the One Bookshelf sites. It gives the stats in strength, intelligence, wisdom, dexterity, constitution, charisma. So the order that was introduced in the Greyhawk Supplementum was the default order up until 2nd edition AD&D. I like it just as much. And of all the free OSR character sheets that you can buy that I'm aware of, this is my favorite one. The design looks like a sheet of lined paper where somebody's just written out the spaces. And it's absolutely everything you need. It looks like, you know, at a glance, it'll be compatible with any OSR rule set or retro clone. It does give the classic 5 saving throws, but if you're doing Swords and Wizardry with the single saving throw, just write that number. To be honest, you know, the fighter gets a +2 to poison or death ray anyway, so you might as well write a +2 in that section, or, you know, write the magic resistances next to the magical saving throws and things like that. But this is just brilliant. So I've got 8 sheets of this. I love this. It's my favorite of them all. I'm also bringing some copies of the Swords and Wizardry Lite blank ones, which are almost as good. Because they're Swords and Wizardry Lite, there's some bits that we won't be using, like the adventure boxes where you take how many adventures you've done, because you level up based on how many adventures you've been on. And the pre-done equipment packs. I was thinking about using those equipment packs to speed up the character creation, but as I said, I decided to use the Untold Adventures style equipment slots instead. Anyways, 3, 6, 9. It's a 9 for cons, so no penalty to cons, so not too bad. This is a low number, but it is just 7 for dex, so just high enough not to get a penalty. Initially, when I read, like, I loved White Box from the first time I read it, but there were a couple of things that gave me pause, where I thought, ooh, I might house rule that different. And one was the way that the attribute bonuses, except for charisma, are different than in the three little brown booklets. And that it's 7 to 14 is plus 0, and it's only 6 or less gives you negative 1, and 15 or more gives you plus 1, and nothing gives you higher than a plus 1. I was thinking, oh, I'll probably house rule that back into the way it actually is in the original three little brown booklets. And the other thing was the single saving throw. I was just like, what? You know, there's never been just a single saving throw. I mean, I can understand more or less why the five saving throws are what they are. Like poison or death ray, those are things just trying to kill you outright. So you're trying to resist something that's just trying to kill you outright. Magic wand is considered less powerful magic than an ordinary spell or than a staff. So it's like weak magic. Turn to stone or paralysis, and I think polymorph also comes into that usually. Those are things that are trying to change your physical being, either trying to turn your organic flesh into stone or trying to turn you into another creature. Dragon breath is usually something you want to jump out of the way of, and then spells and staves, that's powerful magic, more powerful than the magic wands. I assume that's the logic behind those being the five saving throws. As to how the numbers that you need to roll to make those saves were generated, I have no idea where those came from. I'm certain that there is a logic to it, because Gary Gygax did not just make stuff up. I'm sure he thought long and hard about the percentile possibilities of succeeding on those saves at various levels and for various classes. But I look at that spread of numbers and I have no idea how his mind was working when he came up with them. So I'll be the first to admit that I've never got those classic five saves. From a nostalgia point of view, I was disappointed that Swords and Wizardry wasn't using them. Although they do give you the option to use them if you want to. So yeah, the thing is that in play, the single saving throw, it really works. It saves a lot of time because each class gets a certain bonus and a certain type of save, like the poison and death for the fighter and stuff like that. You know, there is a little bit of variation. I mean, look, for instance, already in the game that I run for my kids, the thief's bonus to saves against traps has come into play where because he gets that bonus, he made his save against the poison needle. So it actually works. It sounded weird to me at first, but it works. And the same thing was with the bonuses in White Box as opposed to how they are in the actual three little brown booklets. As they were rolling up my kids' characters, there were more 8s than there were 13s. So it was worth not rewarding the 13s in order to avoid penalizing the 8s. So again, it's another example of it seemed weird to me at first, but actually it does work better, and I'm just going to keep it the way it is in the book. It's a well-designed system, and you know, I'm not gonna mess with it too much. And that's 8, 9 for charisma. So not great, but you know, when you have, if there's 6 or 7 PCs and they can only hire one hireling each, that's still 6 hirelings. So this will be a magic user, and I guess I will let him pick what spell he wants. And we've already got one elf, so I'm going to go ahead and keep him human. Especially because with a 6 strength, this would not be a valuable fighter. So, and it's only 6 hit points. So, oh, let's find out how much gold. Although, what does a magic user need to spend on weapons? Just a couple of daggers. God, that's good. Where was this roll when I was rolling up one of the other stats? 14, so 140, so a rich. And before I buy him some equipment, I'll roll up the stats on the last one. That is 9 for strength. Not a hopeless fighter, but not a particularly gifted one either. 8 intelligence, so probably not a wizard either. If I get low rolls all the way down, aha, another. Oh, this will be a great cleric. So that is 16. This is a better cleric than the first one, isn't it? That's 12 for con. That's decent. And 9 for dex. And it's 11, 12 for charisma. So a much more charismatic character than we've had for the... So I think I'm going to keep this one as a cleric. So if somebody wants to play a thief, they're going to have to play that halfling. Human, and then the hit points are an ordinary 6. 5%. And the gold. That's another really good gold roll. So that is 11, 12, 13, 14, another 140. One of the things that I think the players will be pleasantly surprised at is how cheap a suit of plate armor is. Both the fighters that I rolled up have AC 17 because they were easily able to afford plate mail and a shield. So, yeah, I will buy them their weapons and stuff off screen, as it were. But those are my last two spare characters. So, it is kind of fun for me to keep rolling up spare characters. It's just like a little thing that I do, just get a pool of spare characters in case people die, to keep the game going, quick, to keep, like, you know, to avoid having to stop and roll from scratch. Although I love this meme that was going around, and it was attributed to Bill Webb, but the DM informed a player that they triggered a trap and had to make a save, and they failed their save. So the player's like, I failed the save, what happens? And the DM was like, roll 3d6. And he's like, 8. And he's like, okay, again. And he's like, ooh, 14. And the DM's like, ooh, okay, one more time. And then the player is just about to roll the final 3d6. And he's like, wait a minute, I'm rolling up a new character, haven't I? And I think that would be fun to do, actually, at the table. It's just like, what happens? Okay, roll 3d6, and again, and again, and, you know, that's your new character. Although one of the funniest things I've ever seen, it was one of the earlier episodes of the Swords of Jordova, that's Matt Finch's live stream of Swords and Wizardry. So their cleric died. They were in a room, and they were fighting snakes that came out of this nasty burlap sack. So their cleric died, and so Matt was having him roll up a new character while everybody else was kind of finishing out the combat. So once the combat was over, Matt informed everybody that they start to see some more wiggling coming from under the burlap sack. And to be honest, as a viewer, I thought the same thing that the players did. It's like, oh no, there's still snakes in the bag. So Skeeter Green, playing the elf, fired an arrow at the burlap sack. And so, you know, he rolled and he hit and he rolled damage. And then Matt's like, he said to to Jim, who was playing the cleric, how many hit points does your new character have? And it's like four. And it's like, okay, he's dead too. So the new character was meant to be under the sack. And it was like, now that they killed the snakes in that sack, the character was gonna like pop out from under the sack and be like, I guess thanks for saving me or something. But nobody knew that. So Skeeter, I think rightly, shot the sack and killed the new character. So we had to roll up yet another character. And I think that's got to be the fastest time, like in history or something. That's going to be like up there for a record for the fastest death of a new character, like or the shortest time between having to roll up new characters. So if you're not watching Swords of Jordaa, but you should, it's really entertaining. Its unique selling point as a an actual play broadcast of D&D, I know not everybody likes those. I do. Its unique selling point is that Matt's doing a lot of really great dungeon tiles, and he's putting a little camera in the dungeon tiles, so you see what the characters would be seeing. Basically, it's the camera's the same height that the minis would be, so he shows you what you would be seeing. And that it is worth it alone for that. But actually, I would, even if they stopped that, if they stopped doing that, and Matt said, I don't have time to keep making these dungeon tiles, it's too much work, I would still keep watching the stream because the adventure and the players, and you know, it's just so entertaining. And of all the ones, of all the streams that I watch, or all the actual play things that I watch, it's the one that feels the most authentic to me. It just feels like a bunch of people sitting around, even though they're doing it over Google Hangouts or something, it just feels like a bunch of people sitting around playing D&D. Whereas, you know, some of the ones like Critical Role does not feel like that. It doesn't look like my game, you know, because I don't sit around with a bunch of professional actors basically ad-libbing a really elaborate story. I can see how it's entertaining. I know why people like it. But it's a TV show. It's not a game of D&D. It's just an unscripted improv TV show with D&D as the engine, the creative engine for kind of randomizing or building around that. But yeah, Swords of Jordaa, it feels like a real, like it is a real game of D&D, which is why it feels that way. But it's much more like how the kind of game that I want to be in. And there's great, weird, and wonderful stuff in there, and a lot of weird bespoke stuff. He had an undead plant at one point. He's actually publishing gazetteers about Jordaa in the campaign setting, which you can get those from DriveThruRPG and stuff if you want to actually add any of that craziness to your own game. So yeah, anyways, that's Monday's episode. Prepping for running Swords and Wizardry for grown-ups and playtesting it with my daughter, who once again demonstrates that she is a really great gamer. I need to actually start teaching her how to run a game. She might be getting ready for that. Until then, oh, if I get a chance, I will try to do an episode where I answer some of the calls and stuff this week. But until then, play well and let the dice roll where they may.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.